Hi, I'm Matt Payne, and welcome to 20th Century Revolutions. Episode 2.16, The Cradle of Revolution, The Macedonian Struggle, Part 1. So, I want to start today by giving a shout-out to Patreon subscriber Emil for their contribution to the show. I really appreciate your pledge, and your support helps to keep this thing going. And by the way, the URL for the Patreon page has changed. The new link is patreon.com/mattpayne. I have updated all of the links in the RSS feed and on the website, but just letting you know in case your browser has saved the old link. So if you're trying to reach Patreon and the link is dead, that is why. Again, the new page is patreon.com/mattpayne. And again, I can't thank you all enough for your support. One more shout out to Emil for your pledge. Thanks, Emil. Next, I have a couple of pronunciation corrections. Thank you to listener Sinan. So, as is probably no surprise, I have been butchering the names of two of the Young Turks over the past few episodes. The first is CUP founder and editor at Osmanli, İshak Sükuti. His name is an Arabic version of Isaac, so it is İshak, not İshak. No SH sound. Sorry about that. And then the other is the nickname of Murad Bey, the Young Turk who led the mass defection of Young Turks in Geneva. His nickname is Mizanji, not Minzani. I somehow forgot that the C with the little thing underneath makes the G sound. So, Mizanji, Murad Bey, and İshak Sükuti. We are now in the land of a lot of names, so I'm sure this will not be the last mispronunciation. Thank you again, Sinan, for the help with the pronunciations. Okay, so over the past few episodes, we have been following the many different oppositional groups operating outside of the Ottoman Empire who were all generally pushing for some sort of action to be taken against Sultan Abdülhamid and his repressive autocratic government. These efforts amongst the Young Turks living in exile culminated with the First Congress of the Ottoman Opposition, which we covered last week and which was held in Paris in 1902. And even though this Congress attempted to bring together all the many different groups in exile in order to build a united front strong enough to take down the Sultan, as we saw, the Congress ended up simply hardening the dividing line between two directly opposed camps over the issue of foreign intervention. So, in the years following this 1902 Congress, the oppositional movement operating abroad would become fractured once more. The pro-interventionist camp under the leadership of Prince Sabahaddin and Ismail Kemal would continue to push for a foreign intervention by appealing to great power diplomats and by building alliances with Christian revolutionary groups. And well, as we know, Ahmed Reza, Dr. Nazim, and the rest of the Meshfaret Circle in Paris, together with the activist wing of the CUP in Geneva, had come together at the 1902 Congress to denounce foreign intervention as unpatriotic and ultimately harmful to the national interests of the Ottoman Empire. This anti-interventionist camp had loudly argued that the European great powers only ever had their own interests in mind, and that there was no such thing as a benevolent intervention. Inviting France or Great Britain to meddle in Ottoman affairs, even if the ultimate purpose of this meddling was to dethrone Abdülhamid, would only be harmful, because it was almost guaranteed that the great powers would use this intervention as an excuse to extend their imperialist tentacles even further into the empire. Over the past 50 years, the great powers had been constantly intervening into the Ottoman Empire, and Ahmed Reza and his new coalition argued that this had led the empire to become an impotent shell of its former self. So, following the 1902 Congress, this new anti-interventionist coalition surrounding Ahmed Reza would continue to make these sorts of arguments in their newspapers and journals. And in so doing, they would begin to adopt a much more explicitly anti-imperialist stance. This will be a very important development, because even though the pro-interventionist group surrounding Prince Sabahaddin and Ismail Kemal had been in the quote-unquote majority at the Congress, As we will see, within the empire itself, the anti-interventionist stance was much, much more popular, especially amongst Muslims. And then most importantly, the anti-interventionist stance would become very, very popular amongst disaffected army officers. The critical link in these last few years leading up to the revolution will be the link forged between Ahmed Reza and his anti-imperialist coalition, coupled with the disaffected and soon-to-be revolutionary army officers who had grown increasingly tired of seeing their great empire get pushed around by scheming European diplomats and arrogant European officers. For these soon-to-be revolutionary officers, Abdulhamid was not only a despotic tyrant, but he was also weak and overly submissive when dealing with the great powers. So, the 1908 revolution will be made when these disaffected officers begin to adopt the anti-imperialist and constitutional ideologies of the Young Turk intellectuals operating in Europe. This alliance between the ideologues in Europe and the revolutionary officers in the empire will be the secret revolutionary sauce leading up to 1908. And critically, the forging of this alliance will ultimately launch the political careers of three very important people who will all become important once they tie together these two groups. These people are Dr. Nazım, Dr. Bahattin Şakir, and Mehmet Talat. Because it will not be the emigre intellectuals like Ahmed Reza or Prince Sabahattin who will ultimately overthrow the Sultan. Instead, it will be the CUP agents building a revolutionary network within the empire itself. These on-the-ground organizers, Dr. Nazım, Dr. Şakir, and Mehmet Talat, will act in partnership with disaffected army officers. And this partnership will similarly launch the political careers of these revolutionary officers, who will also become very, very important in the coming years. These revolutionary officers are Enver Bey, Ahmed Niyazi, Cemal Bey, and Mustafa Kemal. Now, all of these revolutionary organizers who I've just named, Dr. Nazım, Dr. Şakir, Mehmet Talat, will emerge from the revolutionary underground in Ottoman Macedonia. And then all of the revolutionary officers who I've just named, Enver Bey, Ahmed Niyazi, Cemal Bey, Mustafa Kemal, will come out of the Third Army of Macedonia. So, in a few episodes, we will be finally introducing these figures who will ultimately be the ones to make the revolution. And in order to get there, we need to dive back into the belly of the beast, into the cradle of the revolution, into Macedonia. To fully understand why Macedonia will ultimately give birth to the 1908 revolution, we need to first understand this thing called the Macedonian struggle. Because the revolutionaries who will take down Abdulhamid and who will then lead the CUP and the entire Ottoman Empire through to its final collapse were all, in one way or another, products of the Macedonian struggle. Enver Bey and Ahmed Niyazi in particular, both of whom will become by far the two most famous revolutionaries amongst the Ottoman public, directly following 1908, initially gained fame as officers fighting Christian guerrilla bands and armed bandits in Macedonia. And even though these Christian guerrillas were their adversaries, these officers will come to respect the fierce determination of these Greek and Bulgarian guerrillas, and they will adopt their revolutionary tactics once they decide to turn their weapons against the Sultan. So let's try and wrap our heads around the Macedonian struggle. No single place quite embodies the dizzying diversity of the Ottoman Empire so much as Macedonia. Home to Bulgarians, Serbs, Turks, Albanians, Sephardic Jews, Macedonian Slavs, Greeks, Roma, Tatars, Vlachs, Circassians, Bosniaks, Armenians, and the Donme, Macedonia had long been the heart of the Ottoman Empire, ethnically, religiously, and commercially. Today, the geographic region of Macedonia encompasses the borderlands of several different Balkan countries, including Greece, Bulgaria, Albania, North Macedonia, Serbia, and Kosovo, And this nexus of borders tellingly points to the strategic, geographic, and really more than anything else, symbolic importance of Macedonia for nearly all the peoples of the Balkans. Put very simply, the Macedonian struggle was essentially a prolonged guerrilla war fought between the many different rival groups, who loosely represented the interests of these future nation-states of the Balkans, with the most active being the Bulgarians, the Greeks, the Serbians, the Macedonian Slavs, the Albanians, and then, of course, the Ottoman authorities. And over the 30-year period between the 1878 Treaty of Berlin and the 1908 Young Turk Revolution, the nature of this conflict would gradually transform. At first, it would be defined by the small Cheti or cleft-style uprisings that we are very familiar with at this point from the Serbian, Greek, Bulgarian, and Armenian liberation struggles. But over the coming decades, largely as a result of the modernization of the region and of aggressive capitalist development in Macedonia, the struggle would eventually come to more closely resemble a modern insurgency, with a prolonged guerrilla war and 20th century-style terrorist attacks, such as bombings, assassinations, political kidnappings, and the works. Now, the last time we talked about the Macedonian struggle was in the context of Bulgarian unification in episode 2.4, the Krasnorazlog Uprising. And if you have some time, it's not a terrible idea to re-listen to that episode, or at least to the second half, because a lot of this is coming out of that episode. But as a quick review, following the 1878 Treaty of Berlin, Bulgarian guerrilla bands quickly began to descend on Macedonia, as the Bulgarian revolutionaries who had led the April Uprising and then fought alongside the Russians to liberate Bulgaria were very angry about the fact that the new Bulgarian principality did not include Thrace or Macedonia, territories that had both been promised to the Bulgarians during the earlier Treaty of San Stefano. As a result of this growing resentment amongst Bulgarian revolutionaries, the Krasnorazlog Uprising had broken out in November of 1878, just a few months after the signing of the Treaty of Berlin. The Krasnorazlog Uprising would in many ways mark the beginning of the Macedonian struggle. As we discussed, this uprising ultimately failed because the Russians were in no mood to launch another costly war against the Ottomans simply to liberate the Slavs of Macedonia. So, the Krasnorazlog Uprising taught the Bulgarians two important lessons. First, that geopolitics had changed following the Treaty of Berlin, and since most of the great powers now wanted to maintain the status quo in the Balkans, the Bulgarians were going to have to achieve their goals without the help of a great power like Russia. And second, they were reminded that Macedonia is a pretty tough nut to crack. So, Bulgarian revolutionaries and Bulgarian state officials within the new principality began to turn their efforts instead towards uniting Eastern Rumelia with the Principality of Bulgaria. And the Bulgarians succeeded in this goal in 1885 when they boldly proclaimed unification without the permission of either the Russians, who thought of Bulgaria essentially as a colony, or the Ottomans, who still technically held suzerainty over Bulgaria. And in the years following Bulgarian unification, the Bulgarians would continue to act very independently, much to the frustration of the Russians, who wanted Bulgaria to simply be their docile satellite in the Balkans. Even though the Krasnorazlog Uprising had ultimately failed, the cause of Macedonian liberation would continue to be very popular within Bulgaria itself. You may remember that after the 1885 unification of Bulgaria with Eastern Rumelia, Bulgarian Prime Minister Petko Karavelov had ominously proclaimed, "Today Thrace, tomorrow Macedonia." And indeed, after the annexation of Eastern Rumelia, which was more commonly called Northern Thrace, the efforts of Bulgarian revolutionaries would turn once more towards Macedonia. One of the main reasons why Macedonia would become such a popular cause within Bulgaria was because a steady stream of Slavic refugees would pour into Bulgaria from Macedonia for decades following the Treaty of Berlin. And while these Slavic-speaking peasants immigrating to Bulgaria of course felt some loyalty to Bulgaria, the real reason why they left their homes in Macedonia was because the Bashibazouks had unleashed a fairly prolonged campaign of terror against Slavic Orthodox communities following the Krasnorazlog uprising. And as Slavic peasants continued to suffer under the Ottoman yoke in Macedonia, the cause of liberating Macedonia and then uniting it with Bulgaria would become increasingly popular, both within Bulgaria itself and across the border in Ottoman Macedonia. Now, those pushing hardest for the Macedonian cause would be the guerrillas of the Cheti warbands. In the 1880s, these Slavic guerrillas would operate largely on their own as isolated groups, though many would develop informal and then later pretty formal ties with the Bulgarian government. Now, the growing presence of Macedonian guerrillas would create a general sense of lawlessness within both Macedonia and Bulgaria, because while many of these guerrillas really were self-sacrificing volunteers willing to die for the liberation of their people, just as many were simply bandits and brigands. So it became quite common for such bandits to extort rich Bulgarians or threaten Bulgarian politicians, claiming that they were doing this on behalf of the Macedonian cause, but really they were just using Macedonia as an excuse to rob people. That is all to say that from the very beginning, it was often pretty hard to distinguish between committed revolutionaries and just cynical bandits trying to make a profit off of the Macedonian cause. And this would become a headache for the brand new Bulgarian principality. But even so, moving into the 1890s, the Bulgarian government would begin to directly work with Bulgarian guerrilla bands operating inside of Macedonia in a more formal manner. Even though the Bulgarians would be the ones most actively trying to infiltrate and annex Macedonia in the years directly following the Congress of Berlin, the Bulgarians were certainly not the only ones laying claim to Macedonia. And in fact, every single one of the new nation-states created at the Congress of Berlin saw it as their historic right to control Macedonia. Bulgaria had been promised Macedonia in the Treaty of San Stefano. The Serbs claimed Macedonia because it had once been part of a medieval Serbian kingdom, and so it had long been included in their so-called Old Serbia or Greater Serbia. Greece felt similarly, citing the classical Hellenic peoples known as the Macedonians, who gave rise to Alexander the Great. And then the Romanians, well, they just kind of felt left out, so not wanting to be outdone by their Balkan neighbors, they would also seek to grow their influence in Macedonia. And then, of course, the Ottomans wanted to continue ruling Macedonia, as they had for the past 500 years. So they probably had the most legit claim of anyone, having administered the region since before conquering Constantinople, as Sultan Murad II had taken Salonika way back in 1430. And ever since this conquest, Macedonia had been the center of Ottoman commerce and administration within the Balkans, as the beating heart of Ottoman Rumelia. Even though basically all of the Christian nation states of the Balkans asserted some sort of claim to Ottoman Macedonia, the Macedonian struggle would come to center mostly around the rivalry between the Greeks and the Bulgarians, and then the Ottoman authorities trying to restore order and put an end to this guerrilla activity in the Ottoman province. The reason that the conflict would come to revolve around the Greek-Bulgarian rivalry is because, first, the vast majority of Christians in Macedonia were either Greek or Slavic. And second, the general condition for Orthodox Christians living in Macedonia would become increasingly terrible in the latter half of the 19th century. This worsening condition grew from a combination of factors, but most of these factors centered around the arrival of nationalism to Macedonia. The process really began with the Greek Revolution, which would indirectly lead to terrible massacres being perpetrated against the Orthodox community of Macedonia. This was most often directed against Greek-speaking Christians, but since Bulgarians worshipped under the Greek Church before 1870, Slavic Christians were quite often swept up in this anti-Christian violence as well. And as is so often the case, this violence against the Orthodox communities only heightened ethnic nationalism even more, as Bulgarian and Greek leaders now felt an urgent need to protect their way of life in Macedonia by using any means necessary. And then fast forward 50 years, and the Congress of Berlin created the Autonomous Principality of Bulgaria. And as we just said, Bulgarian revolutionaries, who were often loosely associated with the Bulgarian government, would begin to form guerrilla Cheti bands in Macedonia in order to both protect Slavic communities from abuse and to bring them over to the Bulgarian cause. And then in later years, Greek revolutionaries, again usually loosely associated with the Greek government, would also begin to form guerrilla bands in the region in order to both protect Greek communities from abuse and to increase the influence of Greece in Macedonia. So, in the years following the achievement of Bulgarian autonomy, the new Bulgarian Principality and the Kingdom of Greece would put more and more resources towards infiltrating Macedonia and bringing the Orthodox peasant population over to their respective sides. Now, even with this increase in activity amongst Bulgarian and Greek revolutionary nationalists, most peasants, whether Slavic or Greek-speaking, did not think of themselves as Greeks or Bulgarians in the way that we would understand it today. Or in other words, Greek-speaking peasants did not inherently profess loyalty to the Greek nation-state, and Slavic-speaking peasants did not inherently profess loyalty to the Bulgarian principality. This loyalty almost always had to be cultivated. So, in Macedonia, ethnic nationalism initially emanated from these newly created nation-states of Bulgaria, Greece, and to a lesser extent, Serbia. In short, nationalism represented a new, elitist, and largely urban ideology that was imposed onto the rural peasants of Macedonia. Because ethnic nationalism was just not an idea that most peasants were at all familiar with, the Macedonian struggle would at first be centered around the rivalry between the Greek and Bulgarian churches. As a quick review, the Bulgarian Exarchate had for centuries been a part of the Greek Patriarchate. But then the Bulgarian Exarchate seceded from the Patriarchate in 1870. Or in simpler language, the Bulgarian Church split off from the Greek Church. And after the Greek and Bulgarian churches split, a fierce rivalry for the loyalty of Orthodox peasants in general, and especially those living in Macedonia, would emerge. Now, what makes this all insanely confusing is that the majority of peasants in Macedonia spoke a dialect of Bulgarian, or at the very least, one of the many South Slavic dialects that were all very close to Bulgarian. And this is why the Bulgarians were initially the ones fighting most fiercely on behalf of their fellow Slavs in Macedonia. But just because these peasants spoke Slavic dialects did not necessarily mean that they identified as being Bulgarian. And quite often, Slavic-speaking peasants would identify as Greeks. Both culturally, they were Hellenized, and religiously, they professed loyalty to the Greek Patriarchate. Now, I don't want to overstate this, because even though there were Slavic-speaking peasants who identified as Greek, at least culturally and religiously, there were still tons of Slavic-speaking peasants who identified very, very strongly as Bulgarian. And this allegiance to Bulgaria would become heightened even more after Macedonia had been promised to the Bulgarians as part of the original treaty at San Stefano, but had then been snatched away at the Congress of Berlin. The lost treaty of San Stefano would create a very strong movement amongst Bulgarian revolutionaries, Bulgarian church leaders, and Bulgarian state officials to achieve autonomy for Macedonia, with the ultimate goal of annexing Macedonia into the Principality of Bulgaria, in the same way that Eastern Rumelia had united with Bulgaria in 1885. So, throughout the 1880s, the struggle to win the hearts and minds of the Macedonian peasantry would be most fervently taken up by Slavic and Bulgarian guerrilla bands who quite often operated completely on their own, but who would also just as often be in direct communication with the Bulgarian government or acting on behalf of the Bulgarian church. And just to paint more of a picture for you here, I want to read a quote from an outsider who observed the sometimes baffling nature of the Macedonian struggle. Because this quote illustrates how national and ethnic identities in Macedonia were just highly unstable and ever shifting. Quote, "I was talking to a wealthy peasant who came in from a neighboring village to Monastir Market. He spoke Greek well, but hardly like a native. 'Is your village Greek?' I asked him, 'or Bulgarian?' 'Well,' he replied, 'it is Bulgarian now, but 4 years ago it was Greek.' The answer seemed to him entirely natural and commonplace. 'How,' I asked in some bewilderment, 'did that miracle come about?' 'Why,' said he, 'we are all poor men, but we want to have our own school and a priest who will look after us properly. We used to have a Greek teacher. We paid him £5 a year and his bread, while the Greek consul paid him another £5. But we had no priest of our own. We shared a priest with several other villages, and he was very unpunctual and remiss. We went to the Greek bishop to complain, but he refused to do anything for us. The Bulgarians heard of this, and they came and made us an offer. They said they would give us a priest who would live in the village and a teacher to whom we need pay nothing. Well, sirs, ours is a poor village, and so, of course, we became Bulgarians." So, even though it is quite unusual for us as modern observers, and was unusual for Western Europeans at the time, used to more fixed ethnic and national identities, this quote demonstrates how ethnic and national allegiance was anything but some fixed, long-established historical certainty. Instead, ethnic and national loyalty was usually a decision. Are you gonna be Bulgarian, or are you gonna be Greek? And the quote also shows how this decision was almost always based on practical concerns, like, what resources can the Bulgarians offer my town that the Greeks cannot offer, and vice versa. So, this was the nature of the Macedonian struggle. People's ethnic and religious loyalties were up for grabs, and within the chaotic and violent environment following the Congress of Berlin, these loyalties could change overnight because changing one's ethnic, national, or religious identity could be the difference between life or death. In the late 19th century, the influence of the Bulgarian church and the new Bulgarian state would grow rapidly and begin to eclipse the influence of the weakened Greek patriarchate as church officials and guerrilla bands fanned out across the Macedonian countryside and began making deals with towns and villages to come over to the Bulgarian side. When Bulgarian guerrillas would try to bring a Macedonian town over to their side, they would essentially do the following. They would speak with the town leaders and inquire as to their church allegiance. If this town leader said that they paid deference to the Greek patriarchate, these Bulgarian guerrillas would do their best to bring the town over to the Bulgarian exarchate. And the way that the Bulgarian guerrillas did this was by first offering certain protections for the town. They would promise to provide the town with a teacher and or priest, and often as not, they would also offer them a share in their plunder. And then they would also just like threateningly carry all of their weapons to these meetings. And if you've seen any pictures of these Bulgarian guerrillas, you will know that their typical wardrobe consisted of two rifles slung over each shoulder, two pistols attached to each hip, and then grenades, ammunition, and bombs hanging from their belts. I mean, sure, you could say no if you were really passionate about staying with the Greek patriarchate, but most town leaders were in fact not suicidal, and they were often genuinely excited about the very real benefits that came with joining the Bulgarian exarchate. The Greek patriarchate was stretched super thin at this point, so the Bulgarian church could often provide resources such as teachers, priests, and money that the Greek patriarchate had been unable to provide for years. So these town officials would quite often agree to the demands of the Bulgarian guerrillas and join up with the Bulgarian church. Then, the next day, the town leader would announce to the people of their town, "People, from now on you are no longer Greeks, you are now all Bulgarians." So, to sum it up, in the years directly following the Congress of Berlin, life for the Orthodox peasants of Macedonia grew increasingly intolerable. And because Bulgarian and Greek guerrilla bands had, well, guns, they could protect a given town from the retribution of the Bashibazouks or from other bandits who littered the Macedonian countryside. And even though Macedonians would eventually come to identify with Bulgarian or Greek nationalism, the desire of peasants to gain some sort of protection within the violent and highly unstable environment of Macedonia during this period was really the biggest thing driving people's national loyalties. Or as one Greek agent put it, quote, "The Christian inhabitants of these parts have reached such a point that they would welcome with open arms not only Russian and Bulgarian bands, but also Indochinese bands, if they would promise them deliverance from the existing yoke." By the end of the 1880s, the Ottomans had more or less reestablished control over Macedonia. But as we have seen, this reassertion of Ottoman rule often came at an appalling cost. So even though some sense of order may have returned to Macedonia, the Christians of the region would continue to heavily resent Ottoman rule. However, moving into the 1890s, the ways in which the Macedonian Christians would resist began to change. Because even though Greek and Bulgarian guerrilla bands would continue to operate out in the countryside, the Ottoman authorities had been able to prevent the emergence of another large-scale revolt since the 1878 Krasnorazlog Uprising. What this meant is that as Macedonia came back under the more centralized control of the Ottomans, the resistance of Christians in the region would not go away, but would instead be forced underground. So, in the 1890s, secret societies would begin to pop up everywhere throughout Macedonia. And in the two decades leading up to 1908, Macedonia would come to be defined by a culture of secrecy, conspiracy, and revolutionary intrigue. The most active of these secret societies would be the Macedonian Revolutionary Organization, or the MRO, which would be formed in 1893 in Macedonia's largest city, Salonika. Originally founded by Macedonian Bulgarians, the MRO would model themselves off of Vasilevsky's Internal Revolutionary Organization, which had played such a pivotal role in the years leading up to the April Uprising and subsequent liberation of Bulgaria. But even though the MRO would maintain a strong Bulgarian identity early on, in later years, they would adopt a more explicitly Macedonian identity and would even begin to preach a supranationalist vision of a multi-ethnic Balkan confederation that was heavily inspired by left-wing international socialism and anarchism. This left wing of the MRO will actually end up electing delegates to the Ottoman parliament after the revolution, the most famous being Jan Sandanski. But more on the MRO and Sandanski later, because we will be dedicating all of next week's episode to their party's development and to the indirect, yet still pivotal role they would play in the Young Turk Revolution. The other major secret societies operating in Macedonia would be the Supreme Macedonian Committee, commonly called the Supremacists, whose members would almost entirely be drawn from the Bulgarian officer corps, which would become radicalized around the Macedonian issue in the 1890s. Similarly, in Greece, hyper-nationalist and expansionist military officers would create the secret society Ethniki Etairia, which advocated the so-called Megali idea that sought to recreate the Byzantine Empire under Greek leadership. So, because we are dedicating all of next week to the Bulgarian and Slavic Macedonian societies, I want to end today by covering the activities of these Greek nationalists in the Ethniki Etairia. Really, ever since the Greek Revolution of the 1820s, there had grown this idea amongst Greek nationalists of liberating all the lands which had risen up during the original revolution and uniting them with the Kingdom of Greece. This idea would come to be called enosis, which in Greek just means union, and enosis was always closely tied to the Megali idea that sought to recreate the Byzantine Empire. So it technically covered a lot of different territories, But the main movement for Enosis would become most pronounced in, of course, Ottoman Macedonia, as well as in Cyprus, which came under the control of the British after the Treaty of Berlin, and finally Crete, which, like Macedonia, had remained under Ottoman control. As we have mentioned in passing, the island of Crete had been in a state of near constant rebellion even before the Greek Revolution. But the most significant revolts in Ottoman Crete would break out first during the Greek Revolution, and then after the island was left under Ottoman control following the revolution, there would be other major revolts in 1841, 1866, and 1878. Each of these rebellions had their own little intricacies, and the 1866 revolt was an especially long and drawn-out affair. But in general, the Cretans just wanted to drive the Ottomans out of Crete and to either establish autonomous rule like the Bulgarians or to unite with the Kingdom of Greece. Throughout this period, the Ottomans were always able to suppress these revolts. However, in the 1878 revolt, which erupted amidst the general chaos of the Great Eastern Crisis and the Russo-Turkish War, the great powers did force the Ottomans to implement certain reforms in Crete, as they had also done in Macedonia and eastern Anatolia, and the Cretans were technically given a level of autonomy as part of the negotiations surrounding the Congress of Berlin. However, as with most of the promises made by the Ottomans at the Congress, these reforms were not carried out in any real meaningful way, and the Ottoman authorities dragged their feet in giving autonomy to the Cretans. Then, throughout the 1890s, the Greek government increasingly began to assert their influence in Crete, especially as the military in Greece became more radically nationalist and expansionist. These hawkish officers would form the Ethniki Etairia in 1895, and they would model their secret society off of the earlier Feliki Etairia that had been so instrumental in launching the Greek Revolution. With the Megali idea as their operating framework, the members of the Ethniki Etairia wanted to assert Greek influence in both Macedonia and in Crete. But as we have said many, many times, Macedonia is a pretty tough nut to crack. So they initially put most of their efforts towards achieving Enosis in Crete. In 1896, the Hamidian massacres had put the old international spotlight on Abdul Hamid's government once more, and Cretan revolutionaries, together with Greek officers in the Ethniki Etairia, decided that it was high time to take their shot. So they launched another anti-Ottoman rebellion in May of 1896. This revolt actually enjoyed some initial success. However, since the Greek military had become so entangled in the Cretan struggle by way of the Ethniki Etairia, the 1896 revolt would eventually lead a full-on war to break out between the Ottoman Empire and the Kingdom of Greece. Now, in a lot of ways, this is exactly the result that hyper-nationalist Greek officers and Cretan rebels had been hoping for. But what these revolutionaries did not realize was that the Greek army was in terrible shape, and the Ottoman army had been recently modernized. So the Ottomans made quick work of the Greeks, and after just a month of fighting, the Greeks were forced to surrender. However, even though the Greeks were quickly defeated, the Cretan revolt itself continued well into 1898. And as the usual atrocities and counter-atrocities began to multiply on the island, the attention of the great powers remained fixed on Crete long after the official war had ended. Eventually, an international squadron representing nearly all of the great powers would come together to expel the Ottomans from the island. And in December of 1898, the autonomous Cretan state was officially proclaimed with the blessing of the great powers. So, Crete would join Egypt, Tunisia, Bosnia-Herzegovina, Bulgaria, and Cyprus as yet another autonomous province now only nominally under Ottoman suzerainty as a result of great power meddling. The Greco-Turkish War, and the ultimate result of the conflict, in which the great powers forced the Ottomans to offer Crete autonomy, even though they had stomped all over the Greeks in the actual war, would have a few important effects, both in Greece and in the Ottoman Empire. To start with Greece, the ease with which the Ottomans had defeated the Greeks made this war a national humiliation in Greece, and people would begin to call for major reforms to be carried out in the Greek army. This process would eventually culminate in 1909, when a coup in Greece would bring Eleftherios Venizelos to power. Venizelos will come to dominate Greek politics in the first decades of the 20th century, and he is sometimes called the maker of modern Greece. Venizelos was from the island of Crete, and he first came to fame fighting against the Ottomans in this 1897 Cretan revolt. So, Venizelos, who will bring Greece into the Balkan Wars and into the First World War on the side of the Entente powers, was a product of the Cretan revolts, and the Megali idea would be a central ideology for Venizelos, as he will push an aggressive expansionist agenda during his time in power. Within the Ottoman Empire, the Cretan Revolt and the Greco-Turkish War would have the overall effect of heightening tensions within Macedonia. There were a few different factors at play here. First, after the great powers drove the Ottomans out of Crete and granted autonomy to the island, the full attention of expansionist officers turned to Macedonia. But at the same time, the Greek position in Macedonia was now more threatened than ever, because after their loss to the Ottomans, the Greeks were forced to pay a huge war indemnity, and the great powers established yet another good old foreign commission to oversee the finances of the Greek government in Athens. So, now saddled with debt and quickly falling under the influence of Western imperialists, the 1897 defeat would weaken the Greek position in Macedonia, and as a result, Bulgaria's position in Macedonia would grow even stronger, moving into the 1900s. The dishonor of losing a war to the Ottomans and to losing traction in Macedonia would lead hyper-nationalist Greek officers to gain more and more power in Greece. And the Macedonian struggle would sort of become a proxy for regaining Greek honor and for continuing to push the ever more popular Megali idea. Practically speaking, this meant that the leaders of the Kingdom of Greece would become ever more entangled in the Macedonian struggle, as they would send more and more arms, troops, missionaries into the region in order to increase Greek influence in Macedonia. Running parallel to this development in Greece, and in part as a reaction to it, Bulgaria, and eventually Serbia as well, would also witness the rising influence of hyper-nationalist officers. These expansionist officers would begin to join secret societies who all sought to increase their nation's influence in Macedonia. These groups would include the aforementioned supremacists in Bulgaria, and later on, they would also include the Black Hand in Serbia, who hoped to annex northern Macedonia into Serbia, and who would, in 10 years' time, entangle the entire world in the maze of Balkan conspiracy, after they assassinate Franz Ferdinand and launch World War I. So, broadly speaking, the Macedonian struggle would become increasingly intense moving into the 20th century, as hyper-nationalist officers in Bulgaria, Greece, and Serbia begin to form secret societies whose primary goal would be establishing their country's influence in Macedonia. And finally, with regard to the 1908 Young Turk Revolution, the dramatic increase in revolutionary conspiracy and the proliferation of secret societies in Macedonia would eventually penetrate the Ottoman army as well. In the early 1900s, Muslim military officers like Enver Bey, Ahmed Niazi, Cemal Bey, and Mustafa Kemal would all come to join secret societies like the Ottoman Freedom Society and eventually the CUP branch of Salonika, whose primary goal would be the protection of the Ottoman fatherland against the infiltration of all these hyper-nationalist officers in Bulgaria, Greece, and Serbia. So, moving into the 20th century, the temperature will continue to rise in Macedonia as a whole bunch of revolutionary dynamite is laid all across the Balkans. And as we will see, the first spark of revolution will be ignited in Macedonia in 1903 with the outbreak of the Ilinden Uprising, in which tens of thousands of Slavs throughout Macedonia and Thrace would rise up against the Ottoman authorities in what would be the largest uprising in Macedonian history. Next week, we will trace the origins of the group who will be the primary organizers of this mass uprising. Meaning that the next couple episodes are going to be a real doozy, with secret brotherhoods, short-lived anarchist communes, terrorist bombing campaigns, and even the very first hostage crisis in American history. So, join me next week as we introduce the Macedonian Revolutionary Organization.